Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the fourth week of January. This week, we are very happy to have for you part two of our show that we recorded with Al Latham a couple of weeks ago. Al worked for the Jefferson County Conservation District for many years and has always been fascinated by the weather. So our topic was weather of the Olympic Peninsula. Al joined us via Zoom, so hopefully the sound quality is not too compromised. Also, a note, when Al speaks of his enviable log of 41 years of rainfall data, he is speaking about rainfall at his property at about 400 feet off Larson Lake Road, which is just south of Chimicum. Before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. This week's sound is from an animal that I have been fascinated with, yet never seen on the Olympic Peninsula, despite my actively looking for them. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you more about it. So to start our discussion on weather forecasting, the most often asked question about the weather is, what does a certain percentage chance of rain mean, Al?
Well, the weather forecasters use the term POP, or probability of precipitation, when describing the percent chance of rain. And POP is defined as the chance of measurable precipitation occurring at any point in a selected area. So it depends on how wide this area they're forecasting for is. Definition means that at any given point in the forecast area, there is a POP percent chance of measurable precipitation during the time period of the forecast. So it is the probability that at least 1/100th of an inch of precipitation will fall on your rooftop if you live in the forecast area.
It means at that given point in time, your chance is like 40%. It doesn't mean that 40% of the area is going to experience rainfall.
Right.
It's a tricky concept. So anyway, in terms of do-it-yourself forecasting, what are the keys to look for in predicting storms or fair weather?
For me, the best ones are cloud types and barometric pressure, the really good tools for, you know, rough weather predictions. That's what we used at camp. If you see large cirrus tails or cirrus clouds, there's a good possibility of rain in 24 hours or so. That's kind of a really good indicator. Puffy cumulus clouds mean it's pretty nice weather until they become cumulonimbus and we get the resulting thunderstorms. There's charts and websites that describe the clouds and what they mean for weather that you can get off the internet. And the forecasters read barometric pressure, with high pressure meaning generally nice weather and low pressure associated with stormy weather. If you have one of the old style barometers, on one side it says good and fair, and then you've got poor on the other side as the needle moves. For instance, if it's a nice day with high pressure, but you notice that the pressure is decreasing rapidly, you know there's a change coming in the weather. So those are my best two indicators.
In preparing for this show, I was reading all kinds of miscellaneous information on weather, and I came across some fascinating tidbits on natural signs of forecasting the weather. Many of these have not held up to scientific scrutiny, like whether the groundhog sees its shadow or not, foretelling in early spring, or whether seeing cows laying down in a field forecasts rain. But there are a few that do. Monitoring strands of kelp, for example, is apparently a great way to judge humidity. The kelp dries to the touch in fine weather, and when it swells and feels damp, rain is threatening. And other good indicators are pine cones, which end up opening in dry weather and then closing up again when rain's on the way. And the chirping of crickets getting louder as temperatures rise is another good one. So do you know of any other good ones, Al?
No, I don't know a lot of these. There's the weather rock that some people use, and they look at it, and if it's raining, the rock is getting wet, and if it's not raining, the rock is dry. But I've always liked the one about the chirping crickets telling you the temperature. And there's a formula to convert cricket chirps to degrees Fahrenheit. You count the number of chirps in 14 seconds, then add 40 to get the temperature.
So
it comes out pretty reasonably close.
That's great. Well, when I had an entomologist on with me, he was telling me the same thing. And I haven't tried it myself, but I need to incorporate it in the things that I do. And I have long wished to set up a weather station of my own, but in characteristic fashion, I've overthought the idea so much that I've never gotten around to it. But I was given one recently, and this is going to be the year that I set it up. What, in your view, are the most important records to keep? And where's the ideal place to set up a weather station?
Well, it's never too late to start, as I said, Deborah. So go for it.
Go for it.
I set up one 41 years ago and started keeping records and have all this data that actually some people find interesting. But the easiest records for comparing different time periods are precipitation, rain and snow, and maximum minimum temperatures. Wind speed is so variable that it's most useful to record high wind speeds. And there are websites that describe the ideal placement for weather instruments and their standards for official weather stations. But not everyone has a perfect site, so set up whatever you've got in the best place you can for getting the data. But you're recording the weather for one spot on the earth and your individual microclimate at that station. Ideally, a rain gauge should be twice as far from obstacles as they are high and 2 feet off the ground in open areas, and in developed areas as far from obstacles as they are high and 5 feet above the ground. Thermometers 4 to 6 feet above the ground and out of the sun at all times. I have mine on a tree, so the limbs provide shade constantly, and there's plenty of airflow around it. If I set it out in the middle of the yard, it's going to read a lot higher temperatures. And note that even though it seems windy, I talked about that, this isn't a good place for wind power. But for wind, unless you have a very high tower, a wind instrument is going to be measuring winds at ground level, and they're affected by trees, buildings, and terrain. An example of a weather station that is set up to meet all the official parameters is the WSU station at Chimicum High School. And you can see that station's data and a photo of it at weather.wsu.edu. And I consult that frequently because I can see what the real-time weather is and look at all their data for past information.
How long have they been taking information there at that WSU station?
I think since about 2016 or 2017.
Uh-huh.
They have all the parameters. They have soil temperature, wind, solar radiation, all the different parameters on that station. So that's a good one to look at.
Yeah. Well, years ago, I was working in the Namib Desert, and it was a fog desert because that was the major source of moisture in that desert was from fog. So mm-hmm. they had a beautiful weather station that was designed to capture the fog and measure that. So there's so many things that you can do, but just to set up a simple rain gauge would be a great way to get started and easy to do.
And that in a max min thermometer give you the most constant information that you can kind of compare from year to year.
Yeah. So what have you found in your 41 years of looking at your rainfall data?
It's always changing.
Yeah.
And I haven't done any real analysis, though, thanks to Excel spreadsheets, which started up long after I started keeping the weather, but all my data is on a spreadsheet. So, you know, I can query it for information. But basically what I look at on that is the monthly rainfall and compare that to the average over the 40 years that I've been here. 30 years is the standard for when they talk about average or quote unquote normal rainfall. It's based on the rainfall in the last 30 years.
Uh-huh. So what's average for where you are per year?
I get about 35 inches of rain here, and Chimicum gets about 25, and Port Townsend gets about 15 or 17, something like that.
That's just amazing that areas that are that close experience such different rainfall. And then you get over to the west side and you're getting, you know, in places up in the mountains, you're getting like 200, right?
It's amazing. Yeah, that's why they call it a rainforest over there.
That's right, yeah. Anyway, another really interesting thing to record with actual, along with actual measurable data, is the seasonality of events, noting the first emerging of leaves, the first arrival of birds. And I'm usually really good about keeping a monthly bird checklist on my property, but not as good as I would like about keeping records on other things. Do you keep these kinds of records along with rainfall, Al?
No, I don't. I did years ago, but I haven't been very good at that. Somebody that does is Phil Andrus, host of Cats in Our Laps, KPTZ Sunday, 7 to 10. And he's done a great job of that for about 40 years at his place, as well as keeping precipitation records. He records things like first and last frost, the first chorus frogs chorusing, a local stream when it dries up and when it begins flowing again. One thing that I use around here a little bit is the first trillium flowering.
And yeah,
just kind of gauge whether it's an early spring or a late spring. But even a cold spring, it doesn't seem to be that much variation. But it's a fun thing for people to do. And over the long term, you might be able to actually document real changes if you live long enough. We're talking, you know, over 50 years, you might see something change.
Yeah. Well, if we all did that, then you could just continue those records on. Yes, it's great for us all to tune in more to what's going on out there on all kinds of levels. And when we spoke earlier on the phone, you talked about how one of the most interesting things to note in the last couple of years of drought is how long it takes to recharge our aquifer. Do you want to speak about that a little bit?
Yeah, after our summers, particularly last one that's real dry, the ditches are dry, ponds are low, and some streams are dry. Since the soils are dry and the water table is low. At some point after the rains start in the fall, there's a lag before the soils become saturated enough for there to be runoff, filling ponds and streams and ditches. So looking at some local records over the past couple years, particularly a friend of mine who keeps track of when his pond fills, it seems to take about 9 to 12 inches of rain starting in October to fill the water table to saturation. The range is due to the intensity of the precipitation. If you get rain, but in small amounts over time, it takes a lot longer than if you get some really good steady rains. The last few years, the saturation was reached as early as late November and as long as early February. Of course, the timing of saturation and runoff is important to the returning salmon. If saturation isn't reached by the time they return to spawn, there will be normal spawning areas that aren't accessible to them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you realize how much difference it makes to an animal like a salmon. Birds can find moisture in a lot of other places, but the salmon are pretty much wed to stream flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some years that I've not seen them at the upper watershed of Chimicum Creek, you know, up above Eagle Mount Road, where some of the best spawning area is, just because it was so dry.
Uh-huh. Do you know what future weather models predict for our area? Given that we know that climate change is going to be a factor, even if we do our best to correct for it, mend our ways, all of those good things?
Well, for our area, the prognostication that I've seen are for warmer, drier summers and wetter winters as time goes by, maybe along the lines of what we've experienced in the last year. But it's really hard to distinguish effects of climate change in the short term, since there's so much normal variability in the weather. So ask me in 50 years and I'll tell you what happened.
Yeah, that's right. It seems that weather forecasting has gotten much more accurate in the last few years. What has allowed for that?
It's pretty amazing. Yeah, that's better sensors, weather satellites, and computer modeling, I think, are the main things. One thing that's helped our area forecast was the establishment of another weather radar site in Southwest Washington, north of Ocean Shores, several years ago. Forecasts now are pretty good for the next 3 days, but accuracy declines after that. But I'm astounded that the weather websites I look at give me hourly forecasts that are generally pretty accurate. And for Chimicum, you know, I look on the web at Chimicum, and it'll give me an hourly forecast that is different from the one if you look at SQIM. So how they do that is just phenomenal. But again, it's those computer models that do that. But still, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me 35,600 times, shame on the weatherman.
Well, we should end our program by talking about our favorite weather resources. I mean, there are a bunch of them in their books. Cliff Mass has a great book. I have his first edition, but he's come out with a revised edition, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. I'm not sure which I have, but that is a good book, The Weather of the Pacific Northwest.
Yes. And he also has a weather blog. Does he come out with that every day?
Not every day, but generally reacts to any big changes in the weather. And he's a really good site when we have, heavy weather coming. Can give a pretty good, accurate description of what's going to happen, better than the TV and radio weather forecasters. He can get a little off with his rants and stuff. But his weather stuff is very good. And that's at cliffmass.blogspot.com.
Yeah, he has a lot of interesting information. He can get on a tear sometimes, and you just have to focus on his knowledge of the weather, which is profound.
If you want to get involved in your weather, the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network is something I report in every day to my precipitation. That's COCORAHS.org. And the Weather Underground website, people that have weather stations that are connected to the web can send their data into that.
I look at that one all the time and really like it. It's so easy to look at. You can go to that 10-day forecast and it gives you, chance of precipitation, wind speed, maximum minimum temperature. It's really nicely summarized. And I've found it to be pretty darn good. As you say, it says 10 day, but usually you can only trust it for 3 or 4 days out. And I look
at that's a great site.
It is. You had a bunch that I didn't know though. I have the windfinder.com I didn't know about. And then my friend Fred Sharp really likes that windy.com site and spelled just like it sounds, windy. I also really like a site called, have you checked out AccuWeather.com?
Yeah, that's when I consult. That and weather.com are the two besides Weather Underground that I look at. And, you know, the Chimicum High School station, that's really interesting. And that's weather.wsu.edu. And it shows stations all over the state. So you can get that information.
That's great. And we're so lucky to have the NOAA site too. I mean, you can go into NOAA on a whole, sometimes it's a little overwhelming because you can go so many different directions. But if you just click on the upper left-hand corner of their website and put in your zip code, then it can give you a forecast for your specific area.
That's it's all very amazing what's available to us. It used to be just listening to the weather report on the radio. And like around here, most of those reports are for Seattle area, so they don't touch on what we're going to be getting. So, but another book that people, if they're interested in weather, should have, if they can find it, is the Golden Guides weather book. I remember those little paperback golden guides to trees and everything else.
Yes.
They have one for weather that we had at our weather station at camp. And I still have one. And that's a really wonderful resource for all things weather. If you can find
well, one. I didn't know anything about that. I also have the DK guides, and they've got them on skeletons and birds and geology, and they have one on weather that actually is really good too, just to summarize the general concepts and visually describe them. It's great for that. Well, it looks like we have come to the end of our time once again. I mean, we could go on and on, though. Do you have anything else that you'd like to make sure that we fit in?
Well, speaking of going on, Phil Andrus and I talk on his radio show around 7:30 every Sunday night about the weather. So if you want to hear two old guys rambling on about the weather, tune in.
Oh, actually, I would love to do that. So 7:30 on Sunday on KPTZ.
Right. Approximately 7:30. You know, Phil.
Well, I'll put that on my list of things to listen to. Thank you so much, Al, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to. I'm sorry it's over Zoom, and hopefully we can be heard. You know, the quality of the audio is a little compromised, and it's not the same as meeting in person, unfortunately. I so enjoy it whenever I run into you, and it's not nearly often enough. So when we can meet in person again, we'll have to do another program on the weather or on the Jefferson County Conservation District work, and we'll get to meet and laugh in person.
Well, let me know when you get your weather station set up.
I am intent. I am. All right. Thank you so much. Take
Bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So here's our mystery sound again. It's a skunk. To be specific, it's the sound of the more common striped skunk. is I could not find a recording of the more reclusive Western spotted skunk for you to listen to. I decided to use this as the mystery sound because my friend Fred Sharp recently showed me a video clip that he had taken last month while staying at his sister's place in the foothills of Port Angeles. He was sleeping in a room near the chicken coop and woke up to the sound of scuttling about outside the glass door. He turned on the camera on his phone and got some amazing footage from this remarkable little animal trying to pick up an egg that one of the hens had laid outside in the yard. These creatures are adorable. I had no idea that they were so cute. Small, about the size of a half-grown kitten, if you don't include the tail, but the tail is extraordinary too, like the end of a white feather boa waving about. It has gorgeous black and white markings, some stripes, some spots. Add to this the fact that they stomp their feet when agitated and do a handstand while waving their tail to warn off potential attackers. How come we don't know more about these amazing animals? Part of the reason is that they're strictly nocturnal. Two skunk species live in Washington, the striped skunk, which is so familiar to so many of us, and the western spotted skunk. Both species occur throughout most lowland areas in Washington, but the striped skunk prefers open fields and pastures and is also seen in some suburban and urban locations, particularly near sources of open water. The spotted skunk is much more likely to be seen in and around forested areas and is not as tolerant of human activity as the striped skunk is. But even though this is supposedly the case, in all of my years doing fieldwork in forested areas on the peninsula, much of it at night, I have never seen one. I would urge our listeners to go do an online search for videos of these animals. They're truly remarkable. But it's also a mystery to me that here in Port Townsend, we do not seem to have the striped skunk either, even though there are plenty of records from SQUIM and PA. This is a shout out to our listeners. Please drop us a line and tell us about your skunk experiences. Have you ever seen either of these species here in Port Townsend? And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the fourth week of January. Thanks very much to Al for joining us and to our ever faithful sound engineer and editor, Nora Petrich. A reminder that you only have a couple more days to order wonderfully affordable bundles of native plants from the Jefferson County Conservation District. It's all online this year. Go to jeffersoncd.org and click on the tab at the top of the page. As always, wishing you happy trails.